That song's called Don't Worry Baby from 1984's How Will the Wolf Survive? Los Lobos. Sounds pretty good. We're talking with Joseph Farrell about his astonishing new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery. As you might recall, after the dust had settled from 9/11, and researchers started digging into the story and finding discrepancies, things that did not make sense, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes a taped confession of sorts from none other than Osama bin Laden. It somehow gets leaked out of whatever cave he's supposedly living in, and basically admits, yeah, those guys were working with me. Congratulations, you did a great job. And it takes some of the fire out of the various alternate scenarios that were being explored in public venues and places like this one. But was that real? Was that really Osama bin Laden, or did someone manufacture that? We're going to talk about that and get into some of the other discrepancies in the physical evidence in this hour with Joseph Farrell, our guest. Stay with us. Joseph Farrell, do you think that Muhammad Atta and his crew knew that this was a suicide mission, or they assumed it was something else?
No, I really don't. I think because you have the stamp and fingerprints of intelligence all over him, I think probably he was of the opinion that he was performing some sort of operation. I don't think that they may have had a clue that it was going to end the way it did. I realize that puts me in kind of a minority in certain circles, but that's my view.
But I mentioned in the last segment about sort of teasing the idea of this convenient bin Laden videotape that came out.
Yes.
Give me your take on that.
Well, I agree with you. We have to go back to those tapes that came out. There was one tape that came out shortly after 9/11 in which bin Laden said that he had nothing to do with it. And then later we have that tape that was used, I think it came out in December of 2001. And that tape to me is highly suspicious because in that tape, bin Laden states that, you know, it was his hope by slamming airplanes into buildings that the fires would cause the structures to weaken and cause, you know, damage and perhaps even pancake the buildings down. And this is very interesting because this is the more or less official narrative that had begun to be adopted by that time, that the airplane fuels weakened the structures, the fires weakened the steel, and so on and so forth. And eventually down the buildings came, you know, the so-called pancake theory that's been put out by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And that tape, if you look at it, immediately when that tape came out, unusually, both Saudi Arabia and Germany challenged the Arabic translations there. And what I find further suspicious about it, George, is that bin Laden, of course, is a member of the bin Laden family. They have an enormous construction firm in Saudi Arabia, and, you know, the family's worth billions of dollars. But for someone connected to a construction firm to make a statement like that, I find highly suspicious, because most people would tell you that the pancake theory simply doesn't work. You don't see much evidence of pancaking, you know, the floors slamming down on top of each other. You don't see that in the rubble pile. And the other problem there is pancaking buildings don't fall at nearly free fall speed. So there are a number of problems with that whole theory, and for bin Laden, you know, with his construction connections, to come out and endorse a theory like that is to my mind, highly suspicious. So I do think that video was probably a bit of deliberately falsified and planted evidence.
I've seen a lot of buildings pancake in the way that the two towers did here in Las Vegas. It's when there's a controlled demolition of an old hotel casino, and they want to take it down in that fashion. And they put explosives on each of the floors, and bam, 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 down they come. The convenience of the leaked bin Laden video, it sort of fits a pattern of other convenient evidence that shows up. Muhammad Atta's luggage left behind with all kinds of incriminating evidence. And then, as you mentioned in the book, slightly burned passports. The only thing that survives from one of the planes that hit the tower is the passport of one of the terrorists.
Right. And supposedly picked up by an anonymous New Yorker passing by and turned into the FBI. Yeah, there's a number of problems here. The whole thing just does not work if you stop and think about it. But I do want to address the pancaking thing for a moment. When you look at pancake buildings that collapse in earthquakes and so on, what you see is the floor is compressed. What you don't see is the tremendous dust ejecta that you have in evidence at Twin Towers. And there should be evidence of pancake floors, and you really just don't see that. What you see is a pile of rubble and pretty much kind of twisted and all torn to shreds and everything. So I would have to disagree a little bit there. But the real problem here is that to pancake buildings and then have them come down at free fall speed, you can't make kinetic energy do both things at the same time. This has always been the problem with that particular theory. And that's really, I think, what got the 9/11 truth community involved in looking at things. I think the Pentagon crash began to unravel the official narrative fairly early on, but then they seem to have turned their attention to the Twin Towers and some of the theories that were being put out there. And that was one of the first things that most of the 9/11 truth community pointed out. You can't have kinetic energy doing two things at the same time and having it come down at nearly free fall speed. So that led to basically the four reigning theories that you have out there. And it's when you start looking at those four theories and a number of other factors that are also part of the events of that day, I think that you see some clear signs of a possible third level that was involved and that may have announced itself in the manner that the towers came down.
Yeah, I think I didn't express myself very well. I wasn't defending that version of it. I just said that I've seen buildings collapse here in Las Vegas. I'm not an engineering whiz, so I wasn't defending one theory or another. But I'm just saying when I have seen buildings collapse that way, it's because there are explosive charges on multiple floors. It's not just one. It's hard to imagine that Bin Laden, the real Bin Laden, ever envisioned slamming a plane into a building and collapsing the whole building. I mean, I can't imagine anybody thinking that would work.
Well, yeah, this is part of the huge problem here. The problem is a simple physics problem. For the columns in that building, which were both the center load-bearing columns and then you had the outward steel cladding on the buildings that were load-bearing, for fire to weaken steel, heat has to be in contact with the steel at melting point for a prolonged period of time in order to do this. And if you look at the fires that were in the Twin Towers on those days, the airplane fuel, particularly in the case of the South Tower, you know, we all saw the videos and you saw that big plume of flame and the ball of flame. Well, that basically is the fuel being ejected. So what you see in the Twin Towers is black smoke. So that's a sign of an oxygen-poor fire. In other words, it's a relatively cool fire. And even then, that's going to have to be in contact for a prolonged period of time and throughout the buildings. This is another thing that is I think, damning to the official narrative, because in order to weaken the columns throughout the entire length of the buildings, the fires have to be burning in the entire length of the building. And this is what you don't see. So there is some other mechanism, and this is where the 9/11 truth community began looking at the videos and the pictures and so on. And the first theory that came out, of course, was the controlled demolition theory. But that quickly evidenced problems of its own, because the first thing that you see in a controlled demolition is they try and collapse the building into the footprint. You don't literally see the buildings being literally peeled like a banana, you know, and collapsing into themselves and expanding outward. The whole point of a controlled demolition is to avoid that sort of stuff. The other problem that you see, and this was a problem with the nanothermite theory, which was kind of the second theory that was put out by Dr. Stephen Jones in a paper that mentioned the presence of nanothermite particles in some of the rubble. The problem with both of those models is that there were a number of very hot spots after 9/11 in the rubble that continued to burn for days and weeks and in some cases months after the event. And those hot spots were on the order of 800 or 900 degrees Fahrenheit. So controlled demolitions and nanothermite don't account for the presence of those hotspots. And that led to the third major theory in the controlled demolitions model, and that was mini nukes, that some sort of miniature nuclear weapons had been used. And the advocates of that theory point quite rightly, in my opinion, to the presence of nuclear residues that are far in excess of natural occurrence of those things in daily background. You had high elements of tritium, you had high numbers of strontium and cesium and things like this. Well, those are normal products of nuclear reactions, and they would account for some of those hot spots. But there again, you start running into problems, because in each of these models of controlled demolitions, it's necessary to prep the building and to do so rather extensively. And the key here is the degree of pulverization that you see in the buildings. You see the concrete, you see the steel, glass, and so on, being pulverized to very, very small particulate matter. The average measurement for the particulate matter residue from the Twin Towers is on the order of 100 microns. Well, you know, that's smaller than a human hair. So in order to pulverize the buildings with explosives that way, you would have to prep the buildings rather thoroughly. And to my mind, it wasn't the opportunity to do that. There were opportunities to prep the buildings, don't get me wrong, but it's the extent of it that would be required that seems to exceed what you actually see in evidence. So that leads to the fourth theory that's been out there. It's probably the most unpopular theory within the 9/11 truth community, with the exception of a few researchers. Judy Wood would be one of them. Jim Hoffman would be another that early on voiced the idea that this might have been brought down by some sort of very exotic energy weapon. And I find that plausible, to the extent that you do have the theory for it, and you do have, with the particulate matter being of such a small average scale, that what you might be looking at with that particular matter is a resonance response to the electrical fields that generated it. And I use the analogy in the book that if you have a block of wood and you've drilled a hole through it, and then a lump of clay, if you want to push the clay through the hole, well, the clay assumes the size of the hole. So in other words, the particulate matter is assuming the size of a resonant field that may have been in effect that day. And I think that's, to my mind, that's a fairly strong argument. The difficulty with that model is that you would require extremely high amounts of energy to do that. Jim Hoffman estimated that, I think it would be around 1.5 gigawatts of power. So, you know, it's an extremely high energy requirement, and that in its turn would require some preparation of the building. So each of the models has their strengths, each of the models has their weaknesses.
Well, we'll come back to the more exotic option a little bit later, and who might be wielding that kind of weaponry.
Right.
You know, as I told you a couple of times, I'm not a student of 9/11, but just as a guy who reads newspapers, there were two things that have always bothered me about it, and that I could not explain, and I've never heard explained very well. One is Building 7.
Right.
And the second is the lack of debris and wreckage and airplane parts around the Pentagon.
Right.
I wonder if you
right.
could take those on and talk about them a little bit in the context of your book.
Well, Building 7, I don't spend much time with, other than right. to point out that with Building 7, it does appear that you have the signature of a standard type of controlled demolition. Because for one thing, the amount of debris or rubble or pulverization is nowhere near the same size that you see with the Twin Towers. And with Building 7, you do have a case of a building that's collapsing more or less into its footprint, which is what you try to do with a standard controlled demolition. And the interesting thing there, I don't point this out in the book, but the interesting thing there is there's that famous case of the BBC reporter standing right in front of Building 7 and saying that it now appears that Building 7 has been demolished as well. And of course, it's still standing, you know, and this was hours before the actual demolition of Building 7. But I do think that was a standard controlled demolition.
And then the Pentagon. You do go into detail about the Pentagon and the problems with that story. I mean, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, the Pentagon case, the Flight 77 hitting the Pentagon case is really where the narrative almost began to unravel on the day itself. And I remember myself, George, watching television that day, seeing the pictures that were flashed on the screen of television of, you know, they're now suspecting a plane has hit the Pentagon, and they're showing us the smoke and everything. And I'm looking at this, and both my friend and I that were watching the TV looked at each other, and we both said almost at the same exact time, where's the debris? You know, where's the airplane? And this was noticed, of course, by Thierry Masson, a French researcher in 9/11, that began pointing this whole thing out. The hole isn't big enough. There appears to be an almost complete lack of debris in the earliest pictures that you see from the Pentagon. Later pictures start showing debris, and then, of course, you've got the government's pictures from the Zacharias Moussaoui prosecution case, where you have all sorts of debris that's being shown. So the way it looks to me, George, is that the data there has been obfuscated. And the other problem with the Pentagon, and I spent a great deal of time with that in the book, is if you look at the eyewitness statements of what they see.
And you listed them all. You list them all.
Well, not all of them, but I list quite a few of them simply to show people the wide divergence of testimony. Some people do see a Boeing 777. Some people even go so far as to say that it was painted like an American airliner. One witness even says it was an American airliner. But other witnesses see something much smaller and much different. And then when you get to the description of the actual impact, the stories there diverge wildly. You've got some witnesses seeing the one of the wings, either the left or the right wing, striking the ground and the aircraft kind of cartwheeling into the Pentagon. Other witnesses see it coming straight in, you know, in full flight trim, which some pilots think would be extremely difficult, if not impossible. You have other witnesses that don't even see a civilian airline, and one witness, two or three, I should say, that described the aircraft as kind of melting into the building, or, you know, just they're describing something that doesn't sound like any sort of standard impact. So the Pentagon aspect of the story, because of all of this high strangeness, is that aspect of the 9/11 narrative that began to collapse almost on the day itself, with I would say within mere days of the event.
I mean, the hole is simply not big enough. I don't know how do you get around that. You can discard everything else, and the hole's just not big enough.
Yeah, it isn't big enough. And normally, in a crash of that nature, you would see, you know, we've all seen pictures of civilian airliner crashes, and usually what you see are the passenger seats, you see the fuselage broken into parts, you see the jet engines, you know, the things that are designed for very high test, and you don't see these things. And in addition, as you point out, the hole is just too dang small for a Boeing 777. And in addition to that, supposedly it's crashing all through all five rings of the Pentagon. And then the exit hole on the innermost ring is very, very small. So that appears to be a very badly obfuscated part of the story. And there are people in the 9/11 truth community that don't believe an airplane struck it at all, you know. And I don't come down on any aspect of this in the book. I simply try and point out that any way you slice it, the narrative there, it has quite a few holes in it.
Literally and figuratively.
Literally and figuratively, absolutely.
And then there's the whole question of, we'll wait till the next segment to talk about the difficulty of any of these maneuvers for an experienced pilot, a jetliner pilot, let alone an inexperienced flight school, ne'er-do-well student. Do you think that someone added wreckage in later photographs that wasn't seen there on the day, right after the crash itself?
I think it's possible, yes, I do. I think it's possible. And the reason being is, by that point, the narrative has begun to take on a life of its own. So you have to contrive the evidence to support the narrative. And again, you know, the JFK assassination is kind of the pattern in this respect, because, again, you see evidence changing during the day on Kennedy's assassination. You see eventually evidence kind of being salted into the picture. I'm thinking particularly of the change from the Mauser to the Mannlicher-Carcano rifle that Oswald allegedly used. So the pattern in that sense, again, resembles what you see on 9/11. So, yeah.
All right. Joseph Farrell, much more to come here. In the next segment, we're going to get into the difficulties that the pilots would have had if they actually had to guide commercial jet liners into these buildings, and then talk about the level two cooperation and who was involved at that level. Much more to come here. Bruce Robison, Kelly Willis, take into the break with Born to Roll, a killer trucker song. Paul McCartney from 1993's Off the Ground. It's called Biker Like an Icon. We're talking with Joseph Farrell, his new book, Hidden Finance, Rogue Networks, and Secret Sorcery, subtitled The Fascist International, 9/11 and Penetrated Operations. Still to come, we find out the connection to possible fascist organizations, the Nazi link, what some of the other additional motives might have been for pulling off something like 9/11, and who may have been involved. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph Farrell, before we jump back into the 9/11 discussion, I wanted to ask you this. I remember reading a novel called The Odessa File years ago. I think it's Frederick Forsyth, a great book. It's about a journalist who goes sort of undercover and infiltrates a neo-Nazi group, the remnants of the Third Reich, and all kinds of trouble ensues for him. You've been writing about Nazis and what's left of the Third Reich and how this organization still exists at meta levels for a while now. Is there risk?
Well, I've always operated under the assumption that there is. I've had, as I think I've said to you on a couple of occasions, I've had to move a couple of times due to some circumstances. I've had various strange people crawling out of the woodwork at various points offering me so-called insider information. And I'm a pure researcher. I just don't go down that avenue. Others do. But I try and stick to facts that are out in the public record and to connect dots and try and present a synthetic picture. But I do assume that there's some risk.
Let's talk about the difficulty that any pilot, let alone a student pilot, terrorist, operative, whatever you want to call these guys, Atta and his crew, the difficulties of steering a commercial jetliner into the towers and hitting them right where you want to hit them, or even more difficult, probably, the Pentagon.
Well, yeah, this was always the problem with the Flight 77 Pentagon story. Even Hosni Mubarak, as I mentioned earlier, pointed this out, that, you know, when you're flying a plane at that altitude, you're essentially flying it through an obstacle course. You have to be extremely familiar with the area. And Hani Hanjour, the alleged pilot of Flight 77, you know, most of his flight instructors say that this guy could barely pilot a Cessna, let alone a Boeing 777 in full flight trim. It's next to impossible, and there have been a number of professional pilots that have come out and said that, you know, that maneuver is extraordinarily difficult. It would have been probably something more that a military pilot would be trained to do, and even then, executing it in a Boeing 77 would have been very, very difficult. The same thing with the Twin Towers. There have been a number of pilots that have questioned that whole narrative to try and take a commercial airliner and hit those buildings, and that has led some people to postulate that there may have even been some sort of homing beacon inside the Twin Towers, and for that matter, in the Pentagon. I explore that hypothesis in the book, that have suggested that some sort of remote control was involved. And I think that's a plausible hypothesis, absolutely.
And in the spots where they hit, I mean, you couldn't pick a better spot in at least two of the buildings that were hit. Right.
Yeah. Well, in all three cases, this is where the story begins to show some signs of much deeper players, because there were a number of financial investigations underway, being spearheaded by the Office of Naval Investigations in the Pentagon, which incidentally had their offices in the part of the Pentagon that was struck. So let's stop right there and examine that, because if you're a terrorist intending to strike the military heart of the great Satan, would you execute a difficult-to-execute descending spiraling maneuver, or would you simply crash the aircraft into the top of the building, preferably on the east side where the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense have their offices, rather than steer it in this very complicated maneuver through an obstacle course to strike the offices of Naval Investigation? Well, the answer is no. And that right there is a clue that this is a much bigger thing than simply a terrorist operation. And the other thing about the Twin Towers is where they were striking were offices of financial houses that were cooperating in that investigation. So what's the Office of Naval Investigation investigating? Well, apparently, according to the researches of an excellent set of research by E.P. Heidner, and it's available on the internet. You can Google the name and find out what he's uncovered with the financial aspects of the story. They were investigating a huge financial scandal where apparently $240 billion worth of false financial securities had been created to wage economic warfare on the Soviet Union, and those securities were set to clear during the week of 9/11. And the fact that the planes are striking some of the, you know, precisely at some of the offices where some of these investigations were being cooperated with by various brokerage firms raises the suspicion meter into the red zone on what's happening. Now, interestingly enough, the SEC, as I mentioned earlier in the first hour, suspended its normal securities clearing regulations when 9/11 occurred. What this meant, in effect, was that under normal rules, you cannot substitute securities that are supposed to clear with other securities. But when the rule was suspended, they could do that. So in other words, all of those billions of dollars worth of fake securities were taken off the books and other securities substituted for them. And a huge fraud was covered up that related back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the economic war that was being waged against it. And of course, once you've said that, then you have to have the people in American intelligence that would have been able and in a position to create such securities in the first place. So again, we have level two's fingerprints all over the events of 9/11.
Multiple motives, though, you're talking
multiple
about.
Motives,
I mean,
exactly.
There's multiple benefits for somebody to pull this off.
Right, exactly. You know, the standard reasoning in the 9/11 truth community was that 9/11 was a false flag operation that was perpetrated by the neocon element within the American deep state in order to create a climate of public opinion to project military power into the Middle East and secure the energy resources. And I do think that, as far as it goes, that's true. But in an operation like this, with so many levels, you have several motivations and several objectives being handled very adroitly in one operation designed to accomplish a multitude of objectives. And clearing these securities appears to have been one of them.
So the level one guys, Muhammad Atta, these operatives posing as terrorists and flight students, they have one understanding of what's underway. They think they're working for someone to carry out a certain objective.
Right.
The level two guys, President Bush, Vice
right.
President Cheney,
right.
People inside the U.S. government are going along with it to some extent because they think there's a worthwhile end, whether we need to project American power. Maybe it's for ultimately what they think are good motives, and they're
right.
willing to take a hit and carry this out.
Right.
But it's actually they then come to realize, or maybe they haven't, that they've been used by the level three guys.
Right, exactly. This is exactly what I think happened. And here we get into the reasons why I think there's a third level. And I think there's three principal areas you have to look at. The first is the behavior of President Bush, which we've already talked about, on 9/11 itself. Flying.
Well, let's do that some more, though. I mean, we didn't get into detail. Let's look at that a little bit, about him sitting there reading that book.
Right. He's sitting there very calmly reading My Pet Goat. And according to the official narrative, Andrew Card comes in. We've all seen the videos. He bends down, whispers into President Bush's ear. And Bush takes on that very now famous expression that, you know, indicates tension and anxiety. But he continues with the photo op. Then he gives his press statement after he's done, saying that we're under terrorist attack, I'm flying immediately back to Washington. But then, somewhere between his departure from Emma Booker Elementary and his arrival at Air Force One, the situation has changed. And the best 9/11 researchers out there indicate that at some point, somebody contacts the White House switchboard and indicates their bona fides by dropping a bunch of top secret classified codes that span the length and breadth of the federal bureaucracy. Top secret codes of the FBI, the DEA, the National Reconnaissance Office, and so on and so forth. It's at this juncture, I think, that you see Level 2 realizing that they have a new player that's announced itself. Bush hightails it to Barksdale and Offutt to reassert personal command over the American nuclear forces. I think this is a key, crucial sign that at this juncture they know that the operation's been penetrated. And now let's look at the Twin Towers itself. I've already mentioned the Pentagon, that if this were a standard terrorist operation, they would have dived the aircraft without any fancy maneuvers into the roof of the building and tried to create as much damage as possible rather than targeting a specific area of it. But with the Twin Towers, let's look at something else. And this is something I thought on the day itself. If you are a bunch of neocons trying to create a false flag to project American power into the Middle East, all that would have been necessary to achieve that in terms of public opinion would be to fly the aircraft into the buildings. It's when the buildings come down, I suspect, that you have the announcement of that third player. This was an event I don't think that the Level 2 planners had suspected. And if we factor in the fact that there are nuclear residues and evidence at Ground Zero, which might indicate a sophisticated kind of mini-nuke technology, or if we factor in the peculiar size of the particulate matter from the pulverization of the buildings, which might indicate an exotic weapons technology, then you're dealing with some very serious players with access to some very sophisticated technology, and they know how to use it. And that's what I think is happening on 9/11. I think they announce their presence in that manner through the codes that they've acquired and through the mechanism of destruction of the Twin Towers. At that point, Level 2 is pinned, so to speak, in a classical chess move, because they've got to go through with the original operation. They've got to project military power into the Middle East. But at the other hand, they also have to secure the American federal government and from these types of penetrations. And I find it very interesting that for weeks and months after 9/11, Vice President Dick Cheney sort of dropped right out of sight. He wasn't seen for a very long time. I suspect that what this indicates is that he was involved in trying to clean up the penetrated security and the penetrated continuity of government operations that he himself had helped compose during the Reagan administration. So in other words, he's disappeared and taken care of a security problem. So let's go to another aspect of Level 3. And this is the one, George, that when I found it, I can't convey my reaction of dumbfoundedness, because I suspected that it was there, but I almost didn't want to find it. And this is the banker to the bin Ladens up until 1996. It was a Swiss banker by the name of François Genoux. And when you dig into François Genoux, lo and behold, what do you discover? You discover that this man was the personal financial executor for Dr. Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister. He was also a personal financial officer for Hitler's own private estate. He managed all the Nazi accounts in the Swiss banks for them after the war. He was the personal financier of many of the Nazi rat lines out of Europe. He was a personal friend to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, al-Husseini, who raised Muslim divisions for the Waffen-SS during the war. He was also the financier for the late 1960s kind of terrorist conference, if you will, that was held in Barcelona, Spain, with such people as Yasser Arafat and SS Colonel Otto Skorzeny in attendance. And on top of this, he's the guy that introduced SS General Karl Wolff to Alan Dulles as World War II is closing. And on top of all of this, he is the fellow that connected the Bin Laden group to Deutsche Bank and their kind of consigliere, if you will. So in other words, we have here, for, you know, it's pretty plain that what we have here is a Nazi banker that is stashing all the Bin Laden's money in, of all places, Deutsche Bank. And guess who had accounts at Deutsche Bank? Well, Mohammed Atta. So there's a lot of fingerprints here that go in places you just don't want them to go. And that one thing signals to me that you are possibly dealing with some sort of fascist international or mafia or whatever you wish to call it. I do think it behaves like a mafia that has been in bed with the American deep state at various points since the end of the war. And it looks to me, if you take that line of reasoning a little bit further, it looks to me that the divorce papers were served on 9/11 and that the war on terror may in fact be kind of a cover story for a war of a very, very different nature.
You can kind of see it on President Bush's face as this plays out. I'm not a Bush supporter. I wasn't back then, but I always had a sense that he was and still do, that he's a fairly decent guy. I'm trying to figure out what argument somebody makes to him that right. comes to him and says, we got to pull this off. Thousands of people got to die, but it's really for a long range good. Who right. makes that argument to him? Dick Cheney? And what did he think was going to happen?
Well, I think, again, this goes back to what we discussed in the first hour. I think with all of the alerts that various national intelligence agencies were giving to the United States, some of which that we know did reach President Bush prior to the event, that I think the decision was taken to let the operation go ahead. I don't think they were expecting the damage that was caused, in other words. And again, I think if you look at the destruction of the Twin Towers, that's overkill to achieve their objectives. So it's the destruction, it's the overkill that initially clued me in that we might be dealing with third player. But I don't think they were expecting the degree of destruction that they actually got. And I certainly don't think they were expecting to be served notice that much of the security, top secret security codes had been compromised. And that explains why he makes the rush to Barksdale and Offutt, because if they've got those codes, it would be conceivable that they could use them to launch America's nuclear weapons. So he has to be present at those places to reassert presidential command and control over those forces. And the same thing with Dick Cheney in the White House Situation Room. He has to be there to reassert executive control over an operation that, in my opinion, had by then become evident to them, had gotten out of hand, out of their control, that the whole plan had been penetrated and infiltrated and flipped against them. I think that's very clear. And there's a couple more things I should mention in this respect, George, that indicates that they knew that they were playing with a truly global network of some sort, a kind of extraterritorial state, if you will. One is that Prime Minister Tony Blair at the time in the United Kingdom made a little statement that Al-Qaeda was connected to a global network, and that's what he said, but he never clarified what that global network was. And then just a couple months prior to 9/11, there was a Russian economist, and this was uncovered by Jim Mars. I know you've had him on Coast to Coast many
yes.
times. Jim Mars uncovered something that, again, I found truly astonishing, and that was that a Russian economics advisor to President Putin by the name of Dr. Tatiana Kuryagina had indicated that America, and this is prior to 9/11, incidentally, that America would be attacked on its own soil by a so-called terrorist event that was connected to a global network with, and here came the whopper, with assets in excess of $300 trillion. So in other words, we have from Russia and we have from Tony Blair statements to the effect that there was a global network involved, and the Russian statement is coming before 9/11. And let me add one final thing that I mentioned in my previous book, The Third Way. During the Ukrainian crisis, a Russian economics advisor to President Putin, Sergei Glazyev, wrote an extended op-ed piece on the Ukrainian crisis. And in this op-ed piece, he made the statement that our trouble is not with the Nazis in Kiev, it's with the Nazis in Washington. And those were his exact words, and they were not in the context where he was using a hyperbolic or rhetorical expression of speech.
When we come back, Joseph Farrell, we're going to get into how you see this, the remnants of the Third Reich, the Nazi structure, how it exists, whether it qualifies as a breakaway civilization or maybe something that's more embedded than broken away. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.